Well, I get the pleasure of being the last one for you to listen to for this session, at least. While my presentation is loading, I'm Robert Bossert. I'm with the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Rochester and the Center of Excellence for Suicide Prevention at the Department of Veterans Affairs facility in Canandaigua, New York. I'd hope for a brief break from the snow, but you guys followed me. My co-authors on this are Monica Swan and Manfred Van Dolman, and I'd just like to recognize the grant support for this project that came in part from the National Center for Injury Prevention and Control and the CDC. I have no things to disclose whatsoever. Just very quickly, the title of the slide changed a little bit. We're looking at the characteristics and outcomes for children who endure suicide ideation. Suicide ideation among adolescents is a fairly well-researched topic, less so among younger children. One of the strengths of this presentation, I hope, and this is going to be a little different from the two presentations you've just seen, this one's primarily ideologic in nature. We're interested in understanding at this point the characteristics of children who endure suicide ideation and their longer-term suicide histories or suicide behaviors as they move into adolescence. This particular sample, and I'll describe it a little bit more in depth in a few minutes, is a sample of very high-risk kids who have been investigated for child neglect and abuse. So every one of the children who participates in this study has been, there's at least been an index of suspicion that they've been victimized by physical or sexual abuse or neglect. And the neglect and abuse and victimization has strong associations with mental health outcomes among children and adolescents, including, as you see here, depression, victimization, abuse, perpetration of violence, poor attachment to peers and parents, poor overall physical health and cognitive disability. Suicide ideation among children is less well explored. A majority of the work that we have, as you probably know, is on adolescents when it comes to suicide ideation. We have the Youth Risk Behavior Survey, which every year gives us nice estimates of 18 to 23% of kids in high school endorsing some thoughts of suicide. However, we don't know much about suicide ideation among the younger kids. And in particular, kids who have been investigated by the Child Protective Services system and who have been linked to services and how that may affect long-term trajectories. So we don't know much about them, but we do have unique opportunities if we know more about the characteristics and outcomes of kids who endure suicide ideation as children for identification and intervention as they move through the system. The data we use for this project comes from a study called the National Survey of Child and Adolescent Well-Being. It's a nationally representative study of children who entered Child Protective Services in the year 2000, and they're followed prospectively over time. This allows us to then look at kids who endorse suicide ideation as younger kids and then look at their suicide ideation endorsement as they move into early adolescence and then adolescence. Wave one of data collection was completed early in 2001, and waves three and four, where the children were interviewed, took place 18 and 36 months later. So you have about a three-year window to look at suicide ideation endorsement among this particular group of kids. Wave two, they did not assess the children, so jumping from 1 to 3 to 4, some of you are wondering where two went, the kids weren't interviewed in wave two. So very straightforward objectives for this particular presentation, and that's to describe differences in suicide ideation among children investigated for neglect and or abuse, to identify associations between past suicide ideation and current risk, and to identify differences in correlates over time. I would like to say this is part of a larger continuing body of work on this particular data set in these kids. Some of the things that we've looked at already are the associations between peer attachment and suicide ideation, suicide plans, and also whether or not the abuse and neglect was substantiated. And that had an effect on ideation and neglect. One could theorize, and it turns out to be true, that the substantiated neglect or abuse didn't have any impact on whether or not they endorse suicide behaviors or higher rates of depression or clinically significant symptoms of trauma. And reasonably, that's because of a suboptimal family environment. Suicide ideation was not optimally measured in this particular study, and it was measured by the question, which of the following says how you felt in the past 2 weeks? And the response options were, I do not think about killing myself, I think about killing myself but would not do it, and I want to kill myself. Suicide ideation was defined as any endorsement of suicidal thoughts. Historically, children between the ages of 7 and 10 or less than 10 years of age have not been studied as extensively when it comes to suicide because of concerns of their understanding of the abstract nature of death and suicide. However, there's a growing body of evidence that kids on some level understand what suicide means and at least understand the outcome. And so it's worthwhile, I believe, to begin looking at the long-term outcomes for these kids and to see if, in fact, early expression of suicide ideation is associated with higher risk for suicide attempt and suicide death later on. Analyses for this particular project were limited to participants between age and 7 and 10 years at the time of the first interview, which left us with 1,181 kids to work with. They were pretty evenly distributed over the 4 years that were inclusive in that restriction, and the average age was 8.46 years. I would just like to note a little technical note. If you look, if any of you are familiar with the NSCAW data, the depression screen from which these questions come says 8 years and older that it's given to. However, all the 7-year-olds in this study had response options for the suicide question, suggesting that it was given to the 7-year-olds at all as well, obviously. Demographic characteristics of this particular population, 54% roughly were male. The majority were non-Hispanic white, with the second largest group being non-Hispanic black, Hispanic, and then 89 other that fit the very bad category, but it's what we have. 260 were in out-of-home placement at the time of wave one interview. 119 reported symptoms of clinically significant depression, meaning they scored above the clinically significant threshold on the depression screen. And the same was true, 16.3% had clinically significant symptoms of trauma. This is my attempt at color. Overall, if you look at the youth risk behavior survey, you'll see 18 to 23% of high school students endorsing suicide ideation. If you see the first yellow bar, in this particular subsample of kids 7 to 10 years of age, 30% of them said that they either thought about killing themselves but would not do it, or thought about killing themselves and would do it within 2 weeks before being assessed for the wave one survey data. Almost evenly split among males and females, no distinction there whatsoever. Same with white African American, with lower proportion among Hispanics and the others. And obviously those who had clinically significant depression or trauma had very high rates of endorsing suicide ideation of over 50%. Ran some multivariate logistic regression models to see if, in fact, the differences that were the lack of differences really that were suggested in the prevalence estimates held up in the multivariate regression models. And the only two significant predictors of suicide ideation at wave one were a clinically significant depression and clinically significant trauma. I have to be honest with you, when I first sat down to begin to do these analyses, I fully anticipated what you're going to see next. Well, it didn't actually work out. It's fairly well established, at least among adolescents, that endorsing of suicide behavior or a suicide attempt is a pretty robust predictor of later suicide attempts or continued suicide behavior. So my thinking was, if you have kids between 7 to 10 years of age who are quite young in endorsing suicide, we can expect to see more suicide, well, higher prevalence estimate or higher prevalence of suicide ideation as they age. In fact, that wasn't true. 18 months later, when they were assessed, the average age was about 9.1. 51 reported symptoms of depression, or 4.6%. So those who had clinically significant symptoms of depression at the wave two assessment went decreased, which is what the down arrow is meant to indicate. 88, or 9.7, had clinically significant symptoms of trauma. And 231 reported suicide ideation in the past 2 weeks, down to 20.8%. So the prevalence of suicide ideation actually decreased among this very same group of kids. For those of you who are wondering, since it is a prospective study, none of those 1,181 were lost to attrition between waves one and two, so you had exactly the same sample between waves one and two. However, 38.6% of those who reported ideation at wave one also reported ideation at wave two. So the prevalence among that smaller sample is also high, but it's obviously not one-to-one. When you do the multivariate model, and this time include previous ideation as a predictor, wave one, you'll see the depression is still significant and robustly significant, although the confidence intervals are quite large. Trauma is no longer significant, but borderline significant. And again, the standard error is quite large, so that estimate is probably unreliable with the smaller sample size. But previous ideation is now associated with a very strong protective effect. So the probability of endorsing suicide ideation at wave two, if you endorsed it at wave one, is much, much lower, about 80% lower than it was among those who did not endorse suicide ideation. Wave four was an opportunity to see if that pattern again continued. And again, at this time of an average age of just over 11 years, clinically significant depression and trauma were both again down. Suicide ideation was down to about 17%. Again, higher prevalences among those who endorse suicide ideation, either wave one or wave three. And 53 participants, or roughly 20% of them, reported suicide ideation at all three assessments. There is a very small subgroup which continued to express suicide ideation across the 36-month time period, at least within 2 weeks of each assessment, although it was not the majority of participants. Again, using the very same regression model and effort to include suicide ideation at wave one or three as a predictor at wave four, you see depression and trauma are no longer significant. Again, probably a function of the smaller prevalence of people who had clinically significant symptoms. Wave one ideation was should be red, I'm sorry, it's not. Both wave one and wave three suicide ideation reports were associated with a decreased probability of suicide ideation at wave four. So rather than getting worse, it seems that expressing suicide ideation at any time in the past reduced your probability of expressing it at later time points. So very quickly, in summary, results identify strong correlations between depression and trauma, which is consistent with existing literature. However, those who had clinically significant symptoms, the prevalence at least of those who had clinically significant symptoms, decreased over time. Previous reports of suicide ideation were associated with a reduced probability of current ideation at follow-up. That was somewhat counterintuitive, but a small percentage reported thoughts of suicide across all three assessments. In conclusions, from this limited first glance of this data, prevalence of suicide ideation was highest at the time of first assessment when the kids were youngest, which was, again, counterintuitive going into this at least, thinking that the prevalence of suicide ideation would increase as the kids begin to approach early adolescence. Associations between previous suicide ideation and current thoughts of suicide, however, may be associated with service delivery. We do know that these are kids for whom there was an investigation. If there was something bad happening in their lives, they hopefully, and the preliminary analysis we're doing now do suggest that they're funneled into services and they receive mental health care, primary care, social support for the family, and that can impact their suicide ideation at waves two and three, or three and four. Consistent with decreasing prevalence for symptoms of depression and trauma, that's simply that suicide ideation also decreased the prevalence of clinically significant depression and trauma. Symptomology decreased over time. Lots of limitations with this stuff, though. You've got 7 to 10-year-old kids talking about what it means to kill yourself. The validity of those assessments may not be as good as we would hope it would be. It's all self-reported data, at least the suicide data that's used here from the kids. And it's a very high-risk sample who have definitely received services. So these are kids for whom the home environment is obviously suboptimal, at least if they're being investigated, there's a suspicion that something's going on. These results may not be generalizable to other populations, and associations may be influenced by those variables not considered in these analyses, specifically service delivery. And I'm happy to field questions by email or phone calls or anything else. Thank you.
It's variable because it is kind of district or even school. We do have many schools that get mental health services. I am trying to push in front of kind of, again, the public health approach in looking at school-wide positive behavioral supports because it really has that universal component to it. Prior to this, a lot of the schools weren't changing their policies, weren't changing their behaviors, and then just asking community mental health or other providers to come in and provide deep in mental health services. And I didn't think that that's really effective, nor does it do much to integrate and for schools to recognize the role they have. So right now we have an initiative, it's very slow to take on though, to kind of create funding incentives. As a matter of fact, we work through our Medicaid agency so that schools could expand the population. I think it's in most schools, a lot of times schools have to pay for the school-based mental health services, and it's only for kids under an individualized education plan. This expands it to all kids, even in general education, if you can get bill Medicaid. So that's kind of what I'm trying to take from this public health is to shift it that way. Does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you. And the second question that I had is for Dr. Hadler. I appreciate your presentation as well, giving us the primary care model. I actually work at the VA, and we're looking at patient-aligned care teams and the medical model as well. Just wanted to get a little information about the Rosie versus Ronnie Van Patten lawsuit. Just wanted to find out a little bit about how did that, I was trying to get it from your side, but you only had 17 minutes. How did that lawsuit actually change how the mental health care was going on with the actual patient? I didn't get that.
So you really want to know more about this, literally go Google it, and it'll tell the whole thing. So there's a huge initiative that is basically this particular lawsuit, the remedy for this lawsuit essentially has totally changed the way mental health services are delivered in the state.
Only
Medicaid though.
Okay.
And it's public. So the main thing that they did is they really moved to the concept of wraparound models. So if you have a child that meets criteria for serious emotional disturbances, they can actually then get an advocate, a whole variety of different kinds of services in a wraparound model. And those exist all around the state. So the way that they rolled it out was they started with the screening in primary care sites, then they began to introduce these wraparound models, and then they began to introduce some additional services, including parent advocates. So it's moving along. I cannot tell you what the results are yet. One of the good things is they were mandated by the court, so they had to do it. One of the bad things is that all of the data now is on behalf of the court. So it's very hard for us to be able to actually include it for them. I feel bad for the state as well. They're putting huge amounts of resources into getting the court all of this process information about numbers, which makes it very difficult to get resources to actually look at. So what's happening, and of course, if they were to show anything negative, go back to court,
right?
They would just make them do something else. So it's basically screening started in 2009. So 2008, 2009. So it gives you a flavor for where we are in that whole process.
Thank you.
Did you have a comment? Any other questions? Yeah?
I wanted to know if you wanted a national. You said that you're chairing
The National Association of State Mental Health Program Directors?
Right, the child.
Yeah, the Children's Division.
Mm-hmm. And I wanted to know kind of what it's doing with the public health approach.
Well, right now we're trying to teach it to many of the children's directors. And like I said, it's been really difficult. Even now, we've gone over this for like 2 years, and they still just want to say, well, it's prevention. And so let's move into prevention and try to teach them that. That it's really how you get to prevention as the process. So we've had many webinars and trainings for the children's directors as well as others. I do think it really has brought, they seem very interested in this. I mean, it's because they're advocates in themselves, and so they want to get to the point where children, we really can promote and prevent. So is there more that I could tell you? Or? I just wanted to add the question about the Rosie D. Do you understand the EPSDT concept behind that? Is that fair? Medicaid has kind of a program, early periodic screening, diagnosis, and treatment. And your statement called something different. In Missouri, we call it Healthy Children and Youth. But basically, it says under Medicaid, anything identified through a screening process that requires some level of intervention or further services, if it's identified, needs to be paid for by Medicaid. That scares to death state Medicaid agencies because it can get out of hand because an agency, a provider may be recommending wraparound or treatment family homes, therapeutic foster care, or residential care, and then they have to pay for it whether it's in their state plan or not, whether it's in their package. So it really scares Medicaid agencies.
Well,
I think that was the basis for it.
I'd add that EPSDT says that every poor child is entitled to that screening, but it doesn't provide the funding for that for any state. So it's one of those things where there's just a lot of tension about how to respond to it in a meaningful way. Yes?
I think also, too, because EPSDT, I think like 15 states have actually sued the state to expand the EPSDT funding. To include mental health screening and provide the original treatment. So some states have and some states haven't done that kind of lawsuit. past has forced a lot of people to do more screenings and providing more expansive services. And at the same time, it's federal money coming down through the state that the state has to match. So yes. Like child advocacy groups have sued the state to make them do this. And you're right, they get like all freaked out because they have to all of a sudden have to pay for it. But still, it's a great source for mental health services for children because it provides ancillary care to parents, which helps particularly if like parents are immigrants and the children are born here. So all of a sudden you can open up this world of treatment. But I had actually a question for Dr. Fazar. I was wondering if you looked at the NASA data, if you looked at the difference between kids that were put into foster homes versus kids who were, you know, stayed at home? Out of placement?
The out of home indicator that was good there was just a nod to that. It was called the long term foster care home, for example. Yes, so other analyses we're doing on the specific fact that we're making comparisons between the two.
I was curious about whether or not kids were doing better because they were in foster care or kids that were doing better because they were at home.
Right, and
when
it comes to suicide, I can tell you that it doesn't appear to matter where they are. It has to do with the relationship between child and care. So we'll be looking at moderating immediate effects of relationship status, particularly among younger kids. It's primarily, you know, older adolescents. It's primarily the relationship, the character that really explains the difference in suicide or suicide ideation. So more so than that, whether actually replaced it.
Regardless of whether it's the parent or the foster
parent. Yeah, in NSCOL, clearly the data has some fairly comprehensive household foster information. We've tried several different configurations to biological parents, to parents, to step parents. Some other adult in the household. And so far, it's been what's more important to the relationship with caregivers than the composition of the household.
And I tried to include that. Not too much on seasonality, but it's some data.
Yeah, it's complex.
If I could kind of go back to the school of mental health, but just the Bright Futures, part of our Show Me Bright Futures, comes from the Bright Futures materials that have been promoted in advance by so many different organizations. If they have a mental health focus, they have it also in oral health, I think, and obesity or nutrition. And if you want to go to, it's a wonderful resource. That's what we started off training the community, our initial grassroots training initiative early on, was using those materials. If you go to brightfutures.org, again, there's a mental health, dental, and nutrition, I believe. They may have even expanded it more. It has information about normal development in children and adolescents all the way up to 21. And then it also has information about the diagnoses, mental health diagnoses, that are wonderful. And you can download all the material free. You can copy all the material. Use it with parents. Use it with teachers. So it's a great resource to use, particularly for a non-mental health population or audience. So that's where that Bright Futures came from.
Any other questions or comments? Okay.